in our hearts, let us seek God's help as we open this psalm, that he might grant us his word. If you go back to the old law of Israel, in fact it's one of the earliest things after the Ten Commandments that we read. You'll find it first in Exodus chapter 21. You'll also find it reiterated in Deuteronomy chapter 15. In the law of Israel, we find instructions concerning servants, masters and servants. And it was that if a Hebrew took a servant, or had really a slave amongst the Hebrews, that in the seventh year he was to let him go free. But there was also provision there for the servant who was very happy at serving this master, that he could decide to stay. The servant could decide to stay with his master. And it was then that that very picturesque, you might say, event would take place, where the master would take the servant to a door, and it was really to have something behind him, and it was to pierce the ear of the servant, and that piercing was to be a signal that he was to remain a servant of this master forever. So a servant had a choice. He was allowed to take freedom from the master, or he was free to go on serving that master. We saw a recent film recently, and The Artist, it's in black and white, and it is about, it's a recent film, but it's about the silent movie era. And there's a spot in that film where there's an old servant of the lead character in the film, the movie star. The movie star comes on hard times, and eventually he fires this old servant. The old servant cannot understand it. And you see pictures where he stands outside his master's door for day after day. Eventually he disappears, until later in the film you find that all the time he's had an interest in his master, and he serves him and he helps him all the way through. He couldn't separate. He loved his master. Today we have a Psalm 36 where only the second time in the whole Psalter, 150 Psalms, only the second time David calls himself the servant of the Lord. These little titles are part of the original text. They have things to tell us. He wrote this psalm as the servant of the Lord. And I think that's important insight to understand why he says what he does in this psalm. Here he is, as it were, setting out his reasons for continuing in the Lord's service. He tells of the blessings that he gains from serving the Lord. He tells of the honor that he owes to this master. We are to serve the Lord, we too must grasp these same things. We too may take this psalm to renew our trust in the Lord and our service of the Lord. And so let's examine quickly through this morning just a few points in regard to this psalm. First of all, I want to speak about David's need for saying these things. Then you have something of the structure of the psalm. The first four verses speak about the godless, the wicked, talks about men and exposes them. The following section from verse 5 through to verse 9 is a confession of God and his grace. And then from verse 10 to 12 there is a prayer to this same God, and a prayer, I would say, of confidence. But I don't want to just leave it there. I also want to come back and say, well, what then is our need of this psalm? David's need, first then, And then as the psalm unfolds, the godless are exposed. God and his grace is confessed. A prayer of confidence is offered. And then also to consider our need of this psalm. David's need, first of all. We know nothing of the setting in which David may have, from which David might have written this psalm, except there is a clue that it is to the chief musician, and this would suggest that it was in the time when David was king already, in the time that he had been able to appoint a team of musicians, including a chief musician. So that would put it somewhere there in David's maturity, after a life of quite considerable experience. He writes this psalm. The translation of verse 1, as we have it, an oracle within my heart concerning the transgression of the wicked, that translation of the original is well recognized as very difficult. We'll take it as it stands, which is certainly a reasonable translation. As it stands, an oracle within my heart concerning, first of all, the transgression of the wicked. An oracle is a very strong word. And it speaks of someone, you'll see it very often amongst the prophets, it speaks of someone with a word from God. It would indicate that this poet has considered, observed very carefully, and considered very deeply. He gains an understanding of the life of men, I believe, by the Spirit of God being upon him. Every aspect of his human nature has been engaged in this, as I say, careful observation, long reflection, and coming to an understanding with the enabling of God's Spirit. And he has made an assessment which he then lays before us, an assessment regarding men. He speaks of them as the wicked, and we will often, we're in a world where we will often ourselves be inclined to go with others and say that the wicked are the bad guys. They're the ones who perhaps are keep the police on their toes and end up in prison and so on. We would often perhaps go along with that, the wicked. But Paul takes the second part of verse 1 as in a quotation, a series of quotations in Romans chapter 3. It's the conclusion of a series where he's taken from different parts of the Old Testament. And at the beginning of that series, he says, there is none righteous, not one. Shortly after that series, shortly after his quotation here, he says, there is no difference, for all have sinned. He has said, there is no fear of God before his eyes. The people he's talking about are all who have sinned. The wicked are not just those extreme cases. The wicked that David refers to, and certainly that Paul points us to understand, is the condition of all men. There is no difference, for all have sinned, all therefore are have no fear of God before their eyes, all are wicked. It's not necessarily that blatant wrongdoing that many will reject. They're not really the terms that he uses. The more I take time to look at these four verses, the terms are actually very moderate. He doesn't highlight the very extreme sins that we often think of. He talks about the words of his mouth are deceitful. He ceased to be wise and to do good. Even very, very calmly, quietly, in verse 4, he sets himself in a way that is not good. If it is not good, it is evil. If it is not good, even a little, it is wickedness. The fairly moderate terms that he uses here. But there is there a sense, a very strong sense, of the grip that wickedness has on man's heart. That's what David sees. All around him, perhaps even in himself. Without God's Spirit at work. That's his context. He's looked around. He's dwelt on the way that men are living towards one another and towards their God. This is how he portrays the condition of men all around him who do not, verse 10, know the Lord. And those who are upright in heart. In contrast to them, this is the condition of all men. That's his context. That is the way of men. And I'm looking at this, the question, why did David need to write this psalm? Because that is the world in which we live. That is the society we are part of. It's not easy to go on in the Lord as his servant in such circumstances. And I think this is why David has compiled this poem, this oracle, a declaration to set out the truth of the matter in order to reassure himself and reassure his people and reassure his listeners and readers in all the years since. David's need is to establish the truth of the matter regarding men all around him and regarding God. And so he does speak about the godless, the wicked, and he exposes the truth of the matter. They're exposed, they're an expose. There are many things that you'll find, maybe an article in the newspaper, which is an expose of misdemeanors and fraud that's been going on in some kind of business or wherever it is. It's all looked fine. The whole banking industry a few years ago, everyone was so upbeat about it and saying, this is the way of prosperity. Now everybody's down on them because it's been opened up for what it really was. David says it as it is. Yes, as I've said, it's relatively moderate terms. But he says the truth is that men are wicked. Wrongdoing comes from wrong within, wickedness within. There's the rottenness within man, no good thing. I'm not going to go into all the details. It's there in front of you. Dwell on it. Reread it. But just a few parts to highlight what this is about. The deceit of man's mouth, for example. In the context that we've noted, it's what men say about themselves. Men will present themselves in the best possible light. Men will present what they offer in the best possible light and say, look at this, this is what you need. Men can so easily convince us that what is useless is most useful. Men can convince us that evil is good and good is evil. We're always being told that these days is the very scriptural standards the world is saying, that's wrong. And they've convinced the multitude around us. The words of man's mouth, the message that people put across. Just this morning I picked up a note regarding an interview with Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's just retiring as the chief rabbi, at least of a section of the Jewish community. And his concern was a breakdown in society and a breakdown of trust in society. And he says it's due to, yes, an even growing individualism. We've often talked about the individualism that reigns in Western society. He says it's on the increase. There's more to go. And that's about me. It's about self. It's me that matters. That's what you have in verses 1 through to 4. It's about his the wicked devising on his bed things that he thinks about. It's all about himself, wrapped up in himself, deceives himself even. Sets himself in a way that is not good. There's a great contrast, as it were, jump ahead a little bit, between this section where it is about man flatters himself in his own eyes. He's king in his life. And then in the next section you see God, and the psalmist David talks about God's mercy. It talks all about what God will do for you. The contrast between man for himself and God for you, for me, for us. Such a difference. But that is the heart of wickedness, that men will not look to man, to his fellow man. Men will not look to God, but to himself. I'm the one that matters. Evil does not have to be open violence. It doesn't need to be extreme malevolence. It's quite simply, he sets himself in a way that is not good. In verse 4. It is quite simply to not abhor, loathe, reject evil. To him who knows what is good, it is, and does not do it, it is sin, we learn. It's not to say that there are not some many good things that men do in this world. Where does it come from? Ultimately, it comes from the grace of God, working through the mind and the heart of men. His great grace. But at bottom, the condition of man's heart is not what is good. This wise man, others who have given serious thought to the state of things, he approaches it with spiritual insight and with a very clear view of God. Let us hear what he has to say about the way of men. Let us see that have this same clear thinking. Let us recognize the truth of the matter concerning the world around us and the things that man will offer. The following section, verses 5 through to 9, are a confession of God and his grace. There was the exposure of the godless. Now we have God and his grace confessed. It is written, I think, as a corrective. There is that, and if you stop there, you have reason to despair, as far as verse 4. But that's not at all the end of the matter. Do you notice how in the world in which we live, men think they are good, we think we are good, and hold God accountable to us for what goes wrong? There's a disaster in the world. Where is God? Things go well. Excuse me, where is God? It's not the way that men think. David tells us in this psalm, it's the other way around. It's men who are wicked. It is God who is good, and look at how good, just how good this God is. And it's not just a goodness that's kept in himself, but as I said a minute ago, it's something he pours out to these same wicked men. And David comes to this place, and look at the terms. I've said in some ways in verses 1 to 4, they're relatively moderate terms concerning wickedness. But he's not moderate in the least when it comes to verses 5 to 9 and God and his grace. He can't use any bigger terms and ideas. The furthest stretch of his mind he uses to describe, your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. It doesn't just reach to the heavens, it's in the heavens, you might say. And he goes, you know the little song, so wide, so deep, you can't get over it, and so on. He uses exactly these pictures. Your mercy is in the heavens, your faithfulness reaches the clouds, your righteousness like the great mountains, your judgments are a great deep. Some people say that Loch Ness in Scotland, they don't know how deep it is. It's immeasurable. Patches in the oceans, they haven't reached the bottom. Your judgments are a great deep. The way that God is at work. He strikes to the heart of God's radical goodness, His deep goodness, in such contrast to the way of man and even any trace of man's goodness. It is mercy He begins with. Mercy is against what we merit, what we deserve, what we earn. They say, don't they, that there are mountains in the ocean which are taller than Mount Everest. And some of them we can't even see the top of them because the ocean covers them. And if you were to reach the heights of Everest and up there in the clouds and regard that as the heights of God's mercy, we're actually starting down there in the very depths of the ocean, not at land level. We might say, well, this mercy of God is great like the mountains. David sees it as, I'm not just starting where I'm standing. It's mercy, because I ought to be so much deeper in the depths of despair. A genuine examination. Standing before God as God sees it. Genuine examination of our position before Him. We might catch a glimpse, a measure of understanding of the sheer greatness of God's mercy. It's far greater than we think, it's far greater than we'd like to think. But David here has taken time, he's taken the humility to be honest. He comes to appreciate the magnitude of the grace of God. Now, the word grace isn't found in our English translation here, but it wraps up all of these things. What do we have? We have five verses, and he tells us of the magnitude of God's mercy, of His faithfulness, that He maintains righteousness, He passes true judgment, He preserves all creation, His great loving kindness. Think of that word. He gives the fullness of His house. He gives even from the river, speaking of the richness and fullness of His own pleasures. He will satisfy men abundantly. He pours out life in verse 9, and He provides light. And He also gives us the shelter, the shadow of His wings. That's a very rich list of the things, the way that God demonstrates His grace, His mercy to these men who set themselves in a way that is not good. You know, as I said again a minute ago, those reports that come out suggesting that a contract has been misappropriated, has been awarded in an inappropriate way. Maybe a government department has put things out for tender, and for some reason or other, the company that gets the contract, it comes out that they ought not to have got it for various reasons. Something's hidden. That's been put out for tender, what will you offer? One comes with an offer, the other comes with an offer. Which will you take? If you don't have the full story, you may well end up taking the wrong one. It's a bit like that we have here. We're told of the offer that men have. Well, we know the offer that men have. They offer all sorts of things. They offer great success in this world and great honor. Men present this face. They say, look what we will do for you. They even say, God will fail you. That's on one side. That's what's offered on tender to this request. But David does the expose. He reminds us that men look out only for themselves. He reminds us that men cannot provide what is good. And then we turn to see what God offers. Men will offer you the world. But God offers you mercy. God offers you access to Himself. God offers you Himself. His loving kindness. His faithfulness. He will do what He says He will do. We know that so clearly in the giving of His Son. He offers Himself, the shadow of His wings. He will wrap you in His arms. How does that compare? How does man's offer, even of the world, which he cannot give, how does that compare with what God offers? See it as it is, not as man would have you believe. Man rejects God out of hand and says, I have something better. David says, that's not the way at all. Man is deceitful. Look what God will give you, even to Himself. And so we come at the last verses to this prayer of confidence. What else can or should David do but to pray to God? He doesn't presume on those things that he's just outlined, but renews his commitment to dependence upon God. How can I live unless you continue your loving kindness to those who know you and your righteousness to the upright in heart? Unless you prevent the foot of pride coming against me, and unless you prevent the hand of the wicked from driving me away. But you are the God of abundant mercy. He comes in prayer. Prayer of the two parts. First, seeking that safety for himself, in spirit as well as in every other aspect of life. He has talked about the things that he knows now. He requests, therefore, that the Lord will not leave him, but will keep him, will surround him in his heart, in all of his life, in his heart especially. Look at that in verse 11. Let not the foot of pride come against me. What exactly does he mean there? It may be that he's thinking of men around him who are proud and, as it were, would kick him, the foot of pride. Or march against him. Something in those, the picture of the foot. But it may also be in his own heart. And he's seeking God's preserving of his own heart. How easily pride enters in or rears up its head again. Let it not be so. Keep me from it. David has reflected on the great mercy of God. He knows that God looks with kindness and love towards men. He knows, therefore, that he can ask for God to care for him. He knows, in fact, that he must ask. Men will not help him. He must ask this God. He cannot help himself. It's not just to ask anyone. He's the king, after all. Not just a great man. But to ask only this God, our Lord. David offers a prayer. He himself was a great man. He was great in his faith, great in his insights that we've seen a glimpse of this morning. But he tells us too that he can only ever be sure of his way when he renews dependence upon the God of mercy. David was in need of such a reflection as this. because if without it he may well have been bowed down by the wickedness and the enmity of men. So he reflects and opens up the truth regarding man, and especially in the light of the truth concerning God. It's on that basis then that he does renew his commitment to serve his God, but to seek God's help in order to serve and to live well. What about our need? The psalm is in front of us. We can read it. We can sing it. What do we do with it? What's the point of it all? These 3,000 or so years later. Has anything changed since then? Does it still apply? Well, I've just very quickly remarked on what he says about men. Has that changed? I don't think so. Not according to Jonathan Sacks either. Many others, Prime Minister and others, in their more coherent moments would reflect the same. Many people do see trouble in society. And if they don't see it here, they'll see it in other parts of the world. And essentially this is a portrayal. These verses depict exactly the concerns that people have. But while many of these folk might reflect on the conditions, there are not so many who have an idea of what can and must be done. Yet many might see the alternative by pausing and listening to David, by pausing and reflecting on the truth of the world in which we live. A little more humility, maybe a lot more humility, and to see how God has been so abundant in mercy and in grace. And whether it's others, whether others are able to see it, what about you? What about me? Let us be sure to see the truth that David lays before us. Let us see and be sure and lay hold and not let go of the fact that it is in God where love and mercy is to be found. That his works are all out of love and mercy, whether we fully understand them or not. Be assured of this. There is abundant evidence, and especially in our day, 1,000 years or so after David, that his great son demonstrates the mercy of God, our Lord Jesus Christ. And if God is this God of such mercy, such faithfulness, it means he doesn't change. We need not be discouraged by the conditions that we live in. And when there are moments that we are discouraged, call such a declaration to mind. Your mercy, Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Your righteousness is like the great mountains. Your judgments are a great deep. O Lord, you preserve man and beast. Call this declaration to mind. That's what it is, an oracle, an announcement from God. This is how it is. There's a place in Romans where Paul makes a remark. This, I think it applies here, and perhaps not in quite the sense that he meant it. But we have the assurance in this psalm that although sin does abound, yet grace much more abounds. Our own inclination is to sin, to be party with the wicked there. Men can so easily play upon our pride, whether it's from outside or from within, they often combine together. They will often be the hand that drives us away from God, driving a wedge between us. We need to make our hold in this prayer. Let that be our prayer. Lord, don't let that happen, because you are merciful, faithful, righteous. In judgment, you are great. You preserve us, you're precious, your loving kindness. We can trust you. You satisfy us abundantly and fully. you give light and life. Put our trust in him. Come under the shadow of his wings. Folk around you, maybe today in a phone call, maybe tomorrow in the shop or in the workplace, in school, well, not quite yet, huh? But many people will mention God occasionally. These days, more often than not, to blame him for the trouble. And take personal credit for the good, of course. The world around us is powerful. It can have a big impact on individual lives. But we've quoted one, we can remember others who have reflected in the same way. The world is sick and it's going astray. The wrong, the evil, the wickedness seems at times to have the upper hand. Let's go back and stand with David. Let's take the time which he seems to have taken. There's a very strong calmness to what he has to say here. Let us absorb that and carry it with us. He's dwelt on the issue, same issues we face. If for no other reason, you know, all those great stories we have of David, there's a vast wealth of material about his story and his experience. That's the man who wrote this. He's gone through the tests of the wicked men around him. And there was a time too, remember, when he was about to fight Goliath, and he said, "The Lord has been with me, he will be with me." That's what this psalm says. He will not fail. He assures us, and his great son assures us too. He had a joy set before him, which I would like to look at this evening, so that he endured the cross and came through it, because he knew that his God, his Father, was this same Lord, true in faithfulness. And he assures us, go to this God, don't go to men. Their offer, their tender, there's a lot that's hidden underneath. They'll make it look good, but it's not true. Go to this God. Know that he will receive you. He will keep you. He will bless you. Let the praise be his. And his word may be blessed to each of us today. Let us pray to him.